Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Reverend Don Lewis coming to you from witchschool.com. Are you looking for the best in pagan and magical education? With more than 12,000 pages, witchschool.com is like having your own personal library with individual learning assistants to help you study. And Witchschool's anyone, anytime, anywhere education system is available any place on earth, anywhere you are and anytime you want it, as long as you have an internet connection. Witchschool's lifetime memberships are a great value. They really do last a lifetime. They've been there for years and they'll be there for years to come. So get your membership today at witchschool.com.
You're listening to Pagans Tonight. Pagans unite on Pagans Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.
Buenas noches, buenas tardes, buenos días. What am I doing? Good evening, good morning, good night, good second breakfast. Welcome to Lunatic Mondays. As you can see, I'm very lunatic. I was starting the show in Spanish. I don't know what happened. Anyway, welcome to Lunatic Mondays. Today we have a very, very dear friend of mine, Aaron Marsh. Aaron Marsh is a Chicago-based entrepreneur, owner of Nightcap Coffee Bar, and magician. He is currently a member of the Brotherhood of the Phoenix, where he has served as one of the board of directors and currently serves as a spiritual mentor. To learn more about Aaron Marsh and the theme of tonight, here he is. Welcome, honey. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Did you hear me starting the show in Spanish?
I did, but, you know, I just thought that was you being eclectic.
No, that was me being distracted.
Someone's nervous.
Someone's nervous. I'm always nervous. I was telling Aaron behind the scenes that every Monday I get nervous. And you know what, honey? The day I'm not nervous is the day I don't do this show anymore. Because
right on. It has to be a challenge.
Yeah, it brings that adrenaline.
Fun.
Yeah, it's totally fun. And, of course, the topic for tonight, you know, talking about mythology and fairy tales and all that. But before we plunge into the theme of tonight, how are you? It's been a while since we had you on the show, and we want to know how you been, how you doing, what's new and exciting with Nightcap, what's new and exciting with the Brotherhood.
Great. So I'm actually calling in live, coming at you live from Nightcap Coffee Bar tonight.
Yay!
And I've got my coffee ready. And when you said, I was actually just posting that I'm on the radio right now talking about my favorite things, and then it hit me, wait, coffee and pizza? No, fairy tales. Anyway, mythology. But things are good. The Brotherhood of the Phoenix performed the opening ritual at Pagan Pride this year in September. Then we had a public ritual, which went really well, October 6th or something like that. And next we'll have what we call Shadow Dance, our next ritual in November. And that one is available. That one is specifically for the men of our mysteries. So men who love men over 18 are welcome. And at the end of the show, we'll mention that again and give dates and location and all that. So things are going well.
Yeah. And you're live from Nightcap and I'm live from Nightcap. And I'm live from a very, very clean and very newly organized computer room / office. And if you come to my office today, you will not recognize it. You will be like, am I in the right house? Because it doesn't look like your computer room. You can actually see the desk.
Nice. That means it's organized just in time to like start some new projects and get it all buried again.
You got
right?
it, babe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can have fun getting back to work.
This is the time of organizing and releasing and letting go. Obviously, we're in the, how you say, we're in the heels of Samhain, or we're towards Samhain? What will be the right expression?
what was the second one?
On our way to Samhain.
Sure, I like that. We're on the road to Samhain.
Obviously, that is on the Northern Hemisphere. If there is any, if there is anybody listening to us in the Southern Hemisphere in English, I will be surprised, but please materialize, let us know. Because if that's the case, they will be celebrating Maven, yes? No,
yeah.
Beltane.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So, did you have anything else to announce before we start getting all scholarly?
As of right now, no.
Okay.
Other than, please take it over. It's yours. Go ahead.
Thanks. Okay. So, I guess let's just start with a couple reasons to talk about the topic and some of the terms we'll be using tonight. So, religion for tonight's purposes, I'll define as a belief system that encompasses cosmology, theology, mythology, codes of conduct, interpersonal conduct and ritual, etc. More as well, but those are the main things. Ritual then being the ceremonial actions performed to connect with the divine or supernatural energy that is believed within that ritual. The mythology, the sacred narratives about deity, creation, history, important places or events that inform that belief system. And oftentimes these get collected in a sacred text, along with the codes of conduct, other explanations and justifications, things like that. So, for example, the Code of Hammurabi, or for a more full text with mythologies and codes of conduct, the Old Testament, and then the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Quran. Anything to jump in on yet?
No. This is your area of expertise.
Okay.
I will jump in when we start talking about fairy tales.
Okay. So then, because of tonight's topic, so then let's look at witchcraft, right? Literally, if, again, for tonight's purposes and kind of my personal belief, literally a craft. So a skill, a set of practices, skill set, crafts used to accomplish desired outcomes, usually by supernatural methods, what we would say magic. But it usually happens within a religious belief structure. I would say it happens probably within all religious belief structures, right? Because it's known about all over the world, right? So in that sense, it kind of requires that overarching religious belief structure that witchcraft happens within, and usually at odds with the standard practices or the mainstream version of that religion, or sometimes even as a like a revolutionary or rejection of the usual beliefs of that religion, but it's still happening within that context. Can you you might have some ideas about that. You want to jump in yet?
No.
Oh, okay. But is that controversial for us, or is that like just like, well, yeah, of course?
No, I think it you know, that's basically what it is. And no, I'm gonna let you talk.
Okay. All right. Great. So then, if we're looking at in that sense, right, it happens within a specific religious belief structure, and multiple belief structures, but it happens within the structure of a religious context, and is a set of practices used to utilize supernatural force. It's essentially a type of ritual. It's a type of ritual that happens within that religious context. So it could happen in any, you know, we're on Pagans tonight, so we'll be talking specifically about, the practices of witchcraft within neo-paganism. And then because of that, if neo-paganism is a religion and the religious structure we're looking at, what are the sacred texts? What is the mythology that explains the cosmology and theology and collects the spiritual history? And now this is a great time to ask. So do we have any This is somewhat of a trick question because neo-paganism is such a broad term. You know, it'll encompass many different religions. It's more of like it's more of a type of religion. But so do we have any that fall in that generalization of neo-paganism?
Well, if you talk about the technicality of it, is there a sacred text? No, we do not have a Bible that we follow. We do not have a Quran or a sacred book. Because, and this brings to mind, you know, when somebody tries to make fun of our religion and say, oh, you neo-pagans put a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I will turn around and say, and what's wrong with that? You know, there's nothing wrong with that. However, there at the same time, you could say there's many, and there's none one that is official. Now, depending on the tradition that you follow or the specific neo-pagan or pagan religion that you follow, if you're a Reconstructionist or not, if you follow the Nordic or the Asatru or the one of the Wiccan traditions, etc., then they will be different, I guess. I don't know. That was a trick question.
Sure.
Now,
go ahead.
When you talk about a sacred text, and in Wicca, people say, well, yeah, my sacred text is my Book of Shadows, where I journal my dreams, where I write down my spells and my practices, etc. But it is not a official sacred text. So,
right, and it only has that significance to you. Other people might recognize it as sacred, but they're not going to have the same connection to it that you do, right?
Exactly.
So then what unites us if we don't have this shared history and mythology?
Well, then you go to all the mythologies.
Uh-huh.
And you go to all of the books, to all of the fairy tales, to all of the myths. And I, for one, you know, loving the earth, loving the celestial bodies, well, I guess I will vibrate with those myths that talk about the creation and the goddess dividing herself, giving birth to herself, and then creating the whole world. And when she said, eat from me, and then I will eat you back later.
that's a great example. And then where did you hear, because that's totally a myth and a creation story. So a creationist myth. Where did you hear that, if you remember, like roughly?
I heard it for the first time on the Fellowship of the Goddess from Mexico, Christian Ortiz's classroom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Very cool. So I'd agree. There isn't necessarily there isn't an overarching sacred text. Like there has to be many because, like I said, neo-paganism is a broad term encompassing many different religious groups. But there should be, you know, I would expect there to be some that pop up for those specific groups. But it's not that big a part of our types of religions. And I'd say, you know, there's something freeing about that. The thing is that that an experiential and relevant religion needs to have room for change and personal gnosis, which ours does. But then there seems to be not a lot to bind us in ways of common shared beliefs or common understanding of our life events in a mythic type. Whereas we can still, you know, and we can still look like most people back to classical, say, Greco-Roman myths or things that, you know, a lot of people have just in general. Most of Western society has, you know, like a passing familiarity with the basic names and players in classical Greek myth. But beyond that, you know, general knowledge that it exists, we don't have a lot to really like make our experience sacred in relation to myth. I think that's a little, you know, I think that's a little of a disadvantage of a modern and a modern created religion. But So then, you know, what can we do about it? And what do people look to when they are looking for various mystical texts and information? Just quickly, there's a cool kind of split in the understanding of the ritual aspects of religion and the mythologies of religion and which came first. It was kind of two main camps. And one of them says that ritual developed from myth. And we, you know, that's kind of, I think, how we normally expect it. So we say, like, the pharaoh laid down in his boat and was taken down the Nile because they were reenacting the scenes from the death of Osiris where his body floated down the Nile or something like that. But usually we think of a lot of performances of rituals reenacting key scenes from different myths. There's another approach that says that myths actually developed from the rituals that say in classical Greece, for example, the time between the earliest Greek civilizations and the Homeric or classical period was so many thousands of years that by the time they had started like kind of urbanizing and start developing civilizations that we consider today Greek civilization, they had already had thousands of years of developing ritual, which then they would have probably forgotten what the significance of some of these were. So they actually created myths to go along with the actions that they were already doing in these rituals that were left over from pre-civilization. That's a pretty cool idea too. And it kind of tantalizing, you know, so then was there significance to do some of these myths, or are they just, you know, are they just kind of happenstance and random people making sense of the various circles that they were in? Either way, though, there's definitely a link now between ritual and myth, and almost doesn't matter which came first. But so then what happens now if we have rituals that are not informed by and augmented, made larger by myth? I'd say a lot of the ones that we practice kind of fall into this category. So when we cast a circle per se, we can say what we're doing, we can talk about it logically, but there isn't necessarily a big mythic psychodrama happening where we're reenacting a creationist story that is in the back of our mind, kind of giving us that psychodrama to go along with the action. Do you agree, or does it remind you of some of the mythologies you've heard when we do the opening circle?
What I was thinking right now is when you were talking about the mythology and the ritual, which was first, I was thinking mm-hmm. about, it's like the chicken and the egg.
Yep.
Right?
I kind of knew you'd say that, actually. Yeah. Yeah, I knew you'd say that.
We never
and
know.
And the thing is, both things might have happened, right? Like I used a Greek example and an Egyptian example. The Egyptian one might have come from the myth. The Greek example, you know, the ritual might have been first, you know. So it really could have happened in both places or in both ways, you know, at different times and places.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're talking about opening circle, and what comes to mind is how we, and at least the way I learn it, you call in air, then fire, then water, then earth. And uh-huh. I learn a pretty cool correlation to those because uh-huh. air gives you the idea,
uh-huh.
and then fire gives you the creative ability or the ability to manifest that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then the water gives you the emotion to bring forth that idea. And then mm-hmm. the earth actually manifests it. And that just mm-hmm. reminded me of a myth that you were sharing with us at book club long time ago. I can't remember the
yes.
name of the deity.
Yeah.
But this deity said there was nothing. And then he expanded it himself. It was mm-hmm. a male deity, I think. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, we would have gone over the myth of Amun coming into consciousness from Nun. So
mm-hmm.
the primal serpent and then Amun waking up and realizing that he was you know, a conscious being, but he was surrounded, tangled in the coils of this serpent, which was nothing. It was none, you know, N-U-N, it was none. And, but at the same time, he realized he was also the serpent, right? Because nothing else existed except for him. It's a pretty cool and wild myth that can be interpreted a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. So now when you were mentioning the circle, that's what came to mind, actually, you know, like, okay,
yeah.
So let's
yeah.
have the idea and then
yeah.
create and then put emotion to it and then manifest it. So there
so
you
then,
go.
You know, and we can look at, again, but then this is more of a logic brain type thing, but we could look at the Kabbalistic theory of creation, and there was that creation happened in 10 steps basically, but also in four larger steps. Like those kind of get broken into four worlds, and the same thing. You get a fire world, you get an air world, and these are sort of archetypal versions. But the water, and then finally the last being Earth, and that's manifestation. And so it mimics that as well. But, you know, then we're looking at Judaic mysticism. And so, again, not necessarily a purely neo-pagan religious mythos. But, again, it does give us, it at least gives us an archetype of what we're doing there. I've been reading this book by... an author, Jake Stratton Kent, and called Geosophia. And his book is specifically about ceremonial magic and Galicia, but he links it to the myths, to many, but for this, just for the sake of this book, he links it to the myth of Jason and the Argonauts. And so that the ceremonial magician casting the circle and going around resembles the idea of the magical sailors, the magical Argonauts, going from place to place and meeting the monsters and inhabitants of the other islands. And it's a pretty cool concept. Again, kind of bringing up that there's aspect to these myths that we haven't necessarily correlated to our ritual, but that could be linked, and some of these ritual actions could be calling into. Could be calling into the circle that part of a mythos that we're reconnecting to. But so for our purposes, I know you work a lot with the Mexica deities and look into their myths and things like that. Do those help you when you're looking to connect with these essences? Say that instead in ritual.
Yeah, totally. As a matter of fact. It's funny that you mentioned that, because today that I woke up and the first thought in my mind was clean mm-hmm. the closet, clean the this, clean that, and I say I'm making it such a big deal out of it because I'm not that thorough in my order, and mm-hmm. it felt, you know, like you're separating what can be reused, what can be recycled, what can be donated, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point of time, I'm thinking about the year past and then the year coming and what plans do I have and all that. And the people that I study, the Mexica, the Mesoamerican culture with, they posted that today we're moving to a different trecena, which means to a different count of the time. And then we're also moving to a different veintena, which is like a month count.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so there's a lot of movement happening energetically on the Mesoamerican philosophy. And I was like, wow, you know, I'm in awe because how, without thinking, consciously thinking about it, it happens. Also, obviously, the trecena, the veintena that ends today, it is the trecena of cleaning and cleansing and sweeping the floor and keeping things clean. And, you know, again, without having the knowledge that the veintena ends today, that the month ended today, it was
mm-hmm.
like it has to be done today. So how much of those myths are within us and in our DNA, and we just empathetically, or we just pick up on it, and mm-hmm. how much of it is registered on the back of our mind that we're like, oh yeah, it has to happen this way because the myth says if you go to the next step, you have to sweep the floor and make room for the new stuff. So totally, mm-hmm. you know, those myths. And obviously the closest to my heart is the myth of Tezcatlipoca, you know, and mm-hmm. and how the traditional mythology talk about Tezcatlipoca being the messenger from the underworld and the messenger from the secrets and the one that brings you the obsidian mirror so you can look at yourself and look at the deep truth of yourself. And obviously mm-hmm. being a tarot reader, I vibrate with that so much. Being that he is the ruler of the day that I was born, I was like, yes, thank you.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, how absolutely. Cool. We vibrate with that mythology. I thought you knew.
No, I didn't realize that. How cool. You know, yeah, it's like yeah. it was meant to be.
Well, kind of like magic.
It's like kind of like this, magic.
Like all these mythologies, not only the Mesoamerican traditions, but Roman god knocks on your door and says, you're mine, and uh-huh. I'm here to stay, and without knowing who this god is. Go ahead.
I keep seeing things, and I forgot what the last one was. I almost called and texted you about your specific Roman deity, and it said, besides being, you know, healing and, okay, we're giving it away, but healing and communication and dot, 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 also the deity of dot, 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 and I go, oh, my God, of course it is. You know, I have to tell Laura, and now I forgot what it was, but... But it was you, basically. You know, I go, oh, of yeah. course it is.
Well, he rules merchants, thieves, con uh-huh. artists, healers.
Yeah, thieves. But this one was what, I mean, this was one that I hadn't heard before, and it was pretty funny. And I go, yep, that's Laura.
He's also a psychopath. So, should we mention his name now, since we're calling him so much?
No, that can be a good test for that can be a good test for everybody else. Like I said, we gave it away anyway.
Well, there's a few people in the chat room. Darren is here, Hunter Val is here, and there's a couple of guests. The guests, they can sign on with their Facebook persona so they can chat in the chat room, because that's where
free to jump in with your comments, responses, questions. So I'm not only putting Laura on the spot with all of them.
Yeah, with my lack of knowledge, thank you so much.
But
go ahead.
but you should have some resources for goddess mythology first, at least probably. But where can we look then when we're trying to mythify our religious experience? And is it worth doing then in the practice of course, you know, I've already said, I think religion, so the forms of neo-paganism usually include a mythology, and it helps to unite the common, you know, the common experience between the members of the religion. But is it useful then within the practice of witchcraft too for neo-pagans? So, you know, we've already mentioned you identify with the Mexica and the Mesoamerican essences, and that does help inform your experience. I think you know, I really enjoy looking back at the Greco-Egyptian and Egyptian stories, which we've talked about before. The other thing that I think is pretty common for us, and should be common for at least the witchcraft aspect of it, is fairy tales. The most common ones that people know of are the German fairy tales, because they've come down to us through the Brothers Grimm. But there are, from most parts of the world, it's not all, but for most parts of the world, there are pretty extant collections of fairy tales. So you have even older medieval Italian collections. There's Of course, the French Romantic ones. England did not, as far as I understand it, did not really have too much of its own mythology. Similar to the same reason I'd say as Mexico and the Latin Americas, a lot of it did not survive conquest. So whatever would have been, say, the Druidic and there is definitely a lot of Celtic lore, but whatever would have been England's national mythology probably did not survive, you know, like the Roman takeover. That caused J.R.R. Tolkien to try to write one for England, which then became his mythos that encompasses The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, The Silmarillion, and many other collections of unfinished works. But they do come from all over the world. The most ones, you know, that people are probably familiar with are good old Grimm's fairy tales. And they get pretty witchy. Have you seen any what we would call fairy tales from say Mexico or Central South America?
Not really.
I agree.
No, there's not a whole lot. They are, well, if you look at the Mesoamerican philosophy in a more purist way, all the attributes to these deities are pretty much as fairy tales.
Uh-huh.
But they are not in the description of what a fairy tale could be. You know,
no.
Because they're magical beings, but they're not magical. I mean, there's a great divide between being taking the myth as it was told by the Spaniards and the conquistadors and telling the tale as it's been passed in oral tradition in a more philosophical way. So
yeah.
It could be a tale in itself, and it makes a lot of sense that it was told that way afterwards, after the conquest, so not to forget, and unfortunately has lost its purity, and now it's only the myth, the essences. And that's a whole different show. But no,
sure.
Other, and you know what, my mind, because you know I'm more of a hearing learner, and I obviously was thinking about the fairy tales in Disney, because who hasn't seen all the movies?
Of course.
That they destroyed all the grim endings of all the fairy tales. And
mm-hmm.
I was thinking about Katy La Oruga and La Abeja Maya, which are two fairy tale movies in Spanish from the 80s, but they don't have that rich, they don't have that rich witchy aspect of them. You know, there's a lot
sure.
of movement in the chat, and I just want to share with you.
Oh yeah,
because Hunter Dow says La Verna, and I say nope, it's a male god. So Darren says, I was putting laundry away and I missed the description. It's cuckooey, no. So now they're talking about a Roman god associated with trickery, cunning thieves. So they're talking about Hermes, maybe. I think also there is a Greek version. They're trying to guess which deity, but we're not going to tell them
well. Yet. Well, they're dancing around it. They definitely are.
Yeah, they're very close. Very, very close. So,
okay.
Disney, and I know you and I love Disney, and you and I love
all
of that. Because how's your hashtag? We'll never grow. You never grow,
uh-huh.
you say. So I'm joining. I'll never grow up. What's your take on those versions? Because some of us, kids from the 70s and the 80s and so on, we learned this mythology through Disney movies.
Well, that's why people should always do their own research. read. In all honesty, I love Disney movies, and not for the purposes we're talking about tonight. It's not going to form my religious practice, inform my religious practice at all. But, you know, I think they're beautiful artistry, very entertaining. That was the whole point, is that, you know, they were revised and cultivated to be in its purest entertainment factor, you know, for the audiences of its time, or for those that are being made now for the audiences of our time. And you know, there's still some pretty cool aspects. Like if you go back and watch the first full length animated feature, Snow White, you know, the queen who becomes the hag witch has a cool witchcraft dungeon with skeletons and a raven and her cauldron, and you know, Snow White lives with seven little dwarves who seem right out of J.R.R. Tolkien, but actually predate J.R.R. Tolkien. You know, they're a lot of fun, but we should always, yes, do our own research, and then especially if it was something that calls to you for the purpose of informing our experience as neo-pagans, I would say pick up a copy of Grimm's Fairy Tales, and if you can find one that uses the first publication edition, go for that one. And it has the usuals, you know, the famous Disneyfied fairy tales that we all think of when we think of fairy tales. So Cinderella and Snow White, Sleeping Beauty parts 1 and 2, but then a lot of lesser known ones. So the Nixie from the Mill Pond, the Raven, the one about the juniper tree, and those are really fascinating. You'll see a lot of common motifs, and I wanted to bring this up actually when we were talking about stories that have survived basically conquest, and I think a big part of that is, you know, so like say Mexico, for example, a big part of just culture in general did not survive conquest. So of course, you know, I guess if there were some fanciful stories that people were telling each other and their children, they didn't necessarily survive in that form. And religious histories are kind of something else. But if we look at, if we use Grimm's fairy tales for an example of the form, if you think about it, like, and especially if you think of the Disney versions of some of them, are there really any fairies in them?
Let me think. Well, the godmother on Cinderella, yep. Is she a fairy?
Exactly. So sometimes you get what they specifically call the fairy godmother. We have this weird queen witch thing in Snow White, but at least the way the tales are presented to us, the main protagonists and usually antagonists are humans. I think that's something that people almost forget about, that you know, when they think of fairy tales and then they start thinking of like basically like little Tinkerbell type beings, little diminutive winged creatures. But then when you read fairy tales, there isn't a lot about that. It's not necessarily about fairies, although I do think you find them, especially if you start, you know, looking for them in the works, but sort of about that other place, the place that we enter when we're in ritual, even. So the place where magic happens, and which is sometimes also called fairy. Have you heard fairy used as like a land as opposed to a thing?
Have
you people, and have you people out there? So in the chat rooms and beyond. So the other realm. And there's lots of traditions, or at least there's at least lots of stories of the tradition about this, and you'll hear like I said, you know, some cultic folklore has come down to us, Irish and Welsh and stuff. Stories about so-and-so went for a walk, came back 7 years later, they looked the same. Or they came back 7 years later and they you know, aged 60 years, or so-and-so walked around a hill the wrong way, and next thing they knew, they were trapped inside the hill with the Queen of Fairy, and, you know, and that's where they are now. So we do have these stories about people who get trapped in the other place, or get lost and find themselves in the other place. And this shows up even in that form a little bit in Grimm's Fairy Tales, and one we know really well. what was the one what was the last one you and I went to go see where you said I spoiled the ending?
Oh my God, Hansel and Gretel.
Right. So what happens? They go to the woods and they get lost. And once when they get lost, what do they find? A house made out of candy. Probably impossible, you know, in our reality. Maybe not so impossible if you've crossed over into fairy. And the thing is, when you cross over into the other realms, you're not supposed to eat or drink anything. And what do? They go and munch on the housey. Munchy Munchy Mousy, who's been munching on my housey or something like that, they say in the written version. I think she's probably an evil fairy or witch fairy or some other creature, but that lives in fairy. Another great aspect about a lot of the ones from the British Isles is there's isles of fairy. So mariners get lost at sea and they come to an island where everything is made of gold or everything is peaceful. Usually it's about the gold though. And I think that's a really funny analog or comparison to the Hansel and Gretel story too, because these adult seafaring people are, you know, what would be most valuable of them? Gold. You're starving and you're seven. What's most valuable to you? Candy, you know, cookies.
Of course. Or if you're Aaron and Laura.
Yeah, coffee and pizza. I never thought, you know, I never really thought it would be that hard to refuse the food and drink offered to you when you get, you know, when you actually end up in this other place, but it could happen, you know. They could have Rickabennies.
Hey, no commercials.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there is time for a musical break, and also there's a caller, and I want to go investigate if this caller has a question or if they have something to add. So, since we're talking about fairies, and this is a favorite artist of you and me, we're going to listen to Wendy Rule, of course, with Dance of the Wild Fairies. That gave us 4 minutes break in case you need to go refill that coffee. And we'll be right back in about 4 minutes.
Thank you.
Faded and I could see the mushroom circle of red and white and You won't want to leave, and forever you'll stay, where the vision is bright as spring. Come and dance the wild fairy dance, spin in a circle as fast as light. Once you begin, you are caught in a trance, and the world can grow old in a single night. I wandered alone to the forest one night, led by a music strange and clear. If you happen to pause when the moon is bright and the veils are thin, you will find me here. If the veils are thin, you will find me here.
You're listening to Pagan Tonight. Pagans Unite on Pagan Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.
Thank you for staying with us. We welcome you back. This is Lunatic Mondays. My name is Laura Gonzalez. And let me tell you a little bit about what's going to happen on this show in the future. First and foremost, the most important thing is this show is moving. Starting on December, the first Monday of December, we're going to begin our show at 8 o'clock p.m., 8 p.m. So people wanted the show to be a little earlier, and we had the opportunity to do it an hour earlier. So remember to tune in at 8 o'clock starting on the first week of December. Speaking of which, let me tell you who's coming to the show. If you speak Spanish, on the 24th of October, we're going to have Darío Iván Rosati from Argentina, and he's going to be talking about the I Ching. On November 7th, we're going to have Christian Ortiz. He's going to be talking about goddess activism and paganism. On the 21st of November, we're going to have our one-year anniversary special with various guests. It's going to be a party, so come and join us if you speak Spanish. If you speak English, October 31st, we're going to have a rerun. We're going to have a repeat show from Circle Talk Radio. They allow us to use the audio because I was talking that day about Day of the Dead, the origin and traditions of the Day of the Dead, and we're going to air that on October 31st because most likely I will be partying and asking for a trick and treat out there in the real world. On November 14, we're going to have Dr. Susan Harper. She's going to be talking about goddess activism and paganism. And on November 28, we have our English celebration of our one-year anniversary. Yes, Lunatic Mondays, Lunes Lunaticos is going to be 1 year old on November 28. And Celia Farron is going to be with us. She's going to be my co-host, and we're going to be taking phone calls. And we're going to be having a party, so everybody is welcome. And we welcome back Aaron Marsh. Aaron is talking to us about mythology and fairy tales. And we were listening to Dance of the Wild Fairies with Wendy Rule. That was amazing. I don't know. Did you hear the song? Did it sound correctly to you, Aaron?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why in the studio it sounds like I was saying when you put a 33 on a 45, for those who know.
Oh, yeah. It...
Go ahead.
It's because she sings that one in such a light fairy voice.
Yeah, but the sound itself was weird, and I don't know why that's been happening on the studio. I cannot. People say it sounds okay, so let's go with that. So you were saying about the fairy tales and the fairylands and all that good stuff. So when we go to the fairyland, we cannot eat, even if we take our lunch.
That's really just one of the pieces of folklore that have come down to us is that you don't accept food or drink, and you see that in mythology too. So when Persephone is abducted by Hades. Do you remember why he's able to make a claim that she has to stay with him?
I don't remember exactly, but I think it has to do with the pomegranate.
Correct. So she's eaten possibly 6 pomegranate seeds, and so she stays there for 6 months out of the year. And it's a similar idea that has come down to us about travels in Faerie. If you eat or drink, you'll end up having to stay there, or, you know, like if you eat anything from drink anything from a witch that could be suspicious, you might be transformed. So the cautionary advice is that you don't accept any food or drink when you are traveling into the other land.
Well, we know what happened to the girl. I'm sorry. I was
going
to say, we know what happened to the girl that ate the apple, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and that one's an interesting one. They all might be fairies in that story, although it's never stated. She might be an Italian princess, a German princess. She might be a fairy. Where else are we going? So it is worth taking a look at some of these stories and reading them with a little more scrutinizing gaze. And nothing's going to jump out at you in the sense that, you know, ritual instructions right here. But you will see some reoccurring symbols. An old woman who lives in a cottage, an old woman who lives in the bottom of a pond, a young woman who lives in a body of water or a pond who requires a promise. Talking animals. If you are lost in the woods and you think an animal talks to you, you should listen to it. That is definitely one of the easiest advices that comes out of the Grimm's fairy tales. And other things, you know, treasure chests, not always containing treasure, sacred wells, fortune telling wells. You will notice that there are motifs that come up again and again and again. And so why were they coming up so often? You know, what was the importance of these motifs and who were they important to? And one of the likely explanations is these were either magical or sacred symbols to the earlier cultures and the earlier belief systems. There's also, you'll notice a lot of linkage, like I just mentioned, the classical Greek myth of Persephone and Hades. You'll notice that there are sort of like threads of motifs from various mythologies also woven into the fairy tales. And I'd say that's another argument for the fact that there are aspects of surviving importance, experience, religious beliefs that have worked their way into these stories, which were just, you know, stories that people told themselves around their house or around a campfire, and reutilizing these important magical motifs from various other stories and legends. We've talked a little bit about mythology, not too much. We've been talking about fairy tales as an example of mythology and that they can be looked at mythology. And then briefly, we should just also mention that there has been entries into the pagan and witchcraft mythos since those days. You know, it's harder for a large group of people to suddenly adopt a newer work as a sacred text, but they can be worth looking at. I think the one that would jump out most at us is Aradia, the Gospel of the Witches. It's considered kind of like a Wiccan classic, I think, and it's not specifically Wiccan, but very in tune with it. So Aradia was published in 1899, and that, you know, that predates Wicca by about 50 years. It's, of course, kind of suspect, as pretty much everything that we talk about is. He actually, the sacred scripture of a group of Italian, possibly gypsy witches, that was handed to an American journalist named Charles Leland, and that he translated them from the Italian into English and made them available and published them. It has, you know, it's kind of scrutinized that may or may not be the case. It's very poetic. It's beautiful. It has a goddess creation story using the goddess Diana. who falls in love with Lucifer, the god of light. He's the god of the sun and the moon, the god of light. And she was so enamored by his brilliant beauty that that they have a child together. The child being Aradia, or Aradia, the first witch. And they talk of her that, you know, she's a divine being, she's pure spirit, but that she comes embodied as a human mortal to the world to free those who have been enslaved and teach them the ways of witch and to smite those who are lords and who are rich and are keeping other people in poverty. It's really messianic. It's definitely almost like a counter Jesus Christ gospel, but with a female protagonist. A little bit dated. There's a couple things that would be offensive to a few groups of people. And then, like I said, that the other side, it's really poetic and it really falls in line with modern neo-paganism. Worth a read, but it's not. It doesn't have a broad enough group of faithful followers to really be considered, you know, an overall sacred mythos for us, though it definitely can be used by individuals or covens. And I do think it's worth taking a look at. Another thing I would suggest taking a look at is The Discovery of Witchcraft by Reginald Scott, published in 1584. So this is actually really old. And Reginald Scott was anti the witch trials and the persecution of witches, but not necessarily because he was pro-witch. He actually didn't really believe in them. But he made his book, The Discovery of Witchcraft, and it talks about some stage magic and how a lot of self-proclaimed witches and magicians, especially magicians, were nothing more than scam artists and were using sleight of hand, visual illusion to cheat people and to make them think that they had power. But then it also talks about some very real practicing magicians and gives basically step-by-step instructions to do whole rituals. It's pretty fascinating and really ended up being a great historical record of magic that was being performed in the 1500s. And what's neat is, so then take a look at some of the rituals that are being described there and comparing and contrasting them to what they do now. And you will see that there is some historical precedence to some of the circle aspects that we do now. And then once you've seen that, then filling in the gaps of, okay, and then what is this, you know, what is this evoking in a mythological context? So if by this ritual we're contacting divine, we're contacting that first time when myth first happened, what myths are we actually getting in tune with? And like I said, look at creation stories from various parts of the world, from your personal faith, and fairy stories as well. I think what would be a lovely follow-up too would be to see how different people can incorporate some of the motifs, some of the sacred symbols we talked about that kind of come up again and again into their personal practice. A couple other recommendations: the Pentamerone, older than Grimm's fairy tales, medieval Italian fairy tales that were originally published in the 1600s, still in print, lovely, magical. Some correspondence with Grimm's fairy tales in some of them, and I think lastly, there's a great website if you want to explore fairy tales a little further, and you know, kind of want to be able to browse online. I would say look at Sur La Lune, which is an online website that will host fairy tales from pretty much all over the world. And some of them even have a little annotation or a little analysis. So that's a pretty fun place to go on the internet.
Can you repeat that website?
Sure, Sur La Lune. So S-U-R-L-A-L-U-N-E.
Okay, thank you so much. No, it's not off topic. Hunter Dowell has a comment / question, and he says, hopefully I'm not generalizing here, but why do most pagans adopt myth, legends, tales from ancient Rome or Greek and not mythos from ancient indigenous cultures here in North or South America? He says, this might be totally off topic. I don't think it's off topic. I think it's right on, and it kind of ties on with what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, that there's not a lot of mythology as in fairy tales, but there is a lot of mythology, for what I can speak, on the Mesoamerican philosophical beliefs. However, they are a little bit at odds with the most purest aspect of the philosophy, being that the mythology is more post-conquest. So that's what I have on that. I don't know if you have anything else on that era.
I have sort of like a conflicted answer. I do think that actually we should be looking at and honoring the land that we occupy and the spirits of the land that we occupy. I think the reason it's less common is we're basically neo-paganism is basically kind of like a European revival religion in a sense. So a lot of people who are into it are kind of called to that. I'll say that, and I think that's a total overstatement and you know, maybe totally wrong to say, but I kind of get that feeling. A lot, you know, and then a lot of people in the U.S., you know, actually their families have originated from all over the world, so they're kind of called to those origins as well. I mentioned earlier we all kind of have a passing familiarity with the Olympic classical Greek mythology, so a lot of people are familiar with it, and it's comfortable and it's fun. So in one sense, it's easy, you know, getting into Native American myth and folklore, especially from the United States areas. There are collections of Native American stories, you know, the trickster coyote, and is one that's pretty well known, you know. So they are out there. A lot of times they'll be hobbled together from, or collected and bound together from various different traditions. Like Laura was saying, conquest, you know, did destroy lots of aspects of cultures here. So it's kind of like a collection of pieces, what has survived. So that can be a little hard. I think people also maybe a little conscious about not appropriating them, and two, maybe a little lazy sometimes. You know, classical Greek myth, we're a little familiar with it. It's easy. It's pretty. Getting to know the Native American folk tales and beliefs would take a little work.
And, you know, another thing that just came to mind is a lot of the indigenous people didn't see their deities as gods and goddesses. You know,
correct.
They were more like spirit guiding essences, guiding entities, archetypes, basically. So that could also be, I appreciate you talking about appropriation, because that's a very important one. However, they're also not dressed as gods and goddesses, you know, so
sure.
That could be,
but
also.
Nor are they in fairy tales, you know, so if we're talking about folk tales, things like that, it's more about the stories themselves and the beliefs, and less about aspects of deity. But it is true, when you start looking at Native cultures, Mesoamerican cultures, there might be stories about, you know, wind, you know, and that's what it's known as, wind, so not as personified as in some of the European myths.
Totally. We're going to go to a musical break since we're talking about myths. There is a beautiful song that is called The Goddess and the Weaver, and we'll be back after 4.5 minutes.
You're listening to Pagans Tonight. Pagans Unite on Pagans Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.
Thank you for staying with us. This is Lunatic Mondays, Lunes Lunaticos, either in English or in Espanol. This is your very first bilingual pagan show for Pagans Tonight Radio Network, obviously, by the favor and by the, I can never remember the word, but you know, it's paid by witchcool.com. I don't know, how do you say that? I always think about the word on Spanish, auspiciado, but I cannot ever thought about, I can never ever think about the word in English. How do you say that?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
You know, that is paid for, that is, I don't know. Anyway, thank you for staying here with us. This is Lunatic Mondays, Lunes Lunaticos. We're here with Aaron Marsh talking about mythology and fairy tales. And this is Q&A time. So if you have any questions for Aaron or for me, I probably will provide advice. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. See, Robert told me the right word.
Hi.
Yes, I think so. So if you have any questions about fairy tales or mythology, I do have a question. How do you think that neo-pagans, pagans, or witches started looking at fairy tales for kind of like a reference? How do you think it all happened? By the Arabia?
Yeah, good question. I don't know that. I don't have an answer for you, but because I don't know if it was a revivalist thing or if it always was important. I actually think that it was probably also sometime after the 50s with, I think it was Robert Cochran, started the British Traditional Witchcraft Society. And I think, you know, in an effort to give it a very old world quality, and they used a lot of natural wood and natural, like, nature artifacts as their tools. I think that looking back into the fairy tales as a sacred text was encouraged. This is a little bit of an assumption, but I kind of think that's where it started. And that it was a little bit, that it was considered a record of practices and oral tradition that had survived the persecution of witches. So what is unfortunate, though, is that we actually don't have any of these stories really in what you might call their pure form either. One, for oral stories, there really isn't going to be a pure form. But two, a lot of the stories that were collected by the Brothers Grimm might have been a little bit prettied up before they were given to the brothers. And then it can be seen through the different folios that the brothers actually made changes to the fairy tales with each subsequent edition, or like we would say, with each printing of their collection. So when you look at the first edition, there are differences than in the third edition. They kind of cleaned them up a little bit each time, made them a little bit more sanitary, you could say. But the main gists of them is still there. The sacred symbols are still there, and it has this history of being an oral tradition. So I think, after the 1950s, I think is when people really started looking at them as a record of some of the wisdom that was lost from the witch persecutions. Any other thoughts on that?
No, I'm just wondering which, what mythologies or stories do you think that people can actually connect with, or which ones do you connect with personally?
Sure.
If you would like to share.
So of course, you know, as you just said, you know, it's a very personal thing. which I've already said, you know, I think is a little bit of a disservice to the community that we don't have a big shared mythos. But for mythology, I really I like to look at the Egyptian mythologies, especially the accounts of creation, because there's many accounts of creation. Ceremonial magic, similar to the book I name dropped earlier, Geosophia. I've been looking at Egyptian myth, and especially the Book of the Dead, the Book of Coming Forth by Day, as the archetype of ceremonial magic. And so I've been looking at those two together, and when practicing ritual in my head, try to link it to passages or actions that are described in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And I think, you know, I actually think that might not be far from where some of these practices came from anyways, in all honesty, but they make sense. They make sense for me.
Okay, so there you have it. I'm asking people if they have questions to type them here on the chat room so I can read them to you. And at this moment, I would like to say hi to all the people that are in the chat room. Obviously, Darren, who is the very first one to come into the chat room all the time. Thank you so much, Darren, for listening to us. Hunter Dowell, Dream Master 1. Dream Master, I don't know if you are which pronoun to use with you. And Robert Spellman from Mexico. So hi, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
Robert is here, you know, because he loves fairy tales.
You know, and there have been, we talked about the Disney movies. And I just for the purpose of tonight, I don't want to get too much into modern additions into the mythologies, but going into film, if you look at the Guillermo del Toro films, they really pull in some classic fairy and fairy tale folklore and motif. You remember Pan's Labyrinth, right?
Of course.
Have you seen Pan? Yeah, okay. just a beautiful and accurate portrayal of the types of things that you see in traditional fairy stories. So when she's actually led by a couple diminutive fairy creatures to steal a key, what's the only rule that she's given is she mustn't eat or drink anything. Of course she does. Of course a big monster wakes up. But it's right out of the stories we were talking about earlier with the, when you cross over to the other side, you can't accept any food or drink. We have the use of a mandrake root spell, feeding it blood, feeding it milk, and letting it be the sympathetic link between that and a human target. Creating doorways to travel between worlds, and then the mythological creatures themselves, so the faun and the fairies and the monsters, the giant toad living under a tree. That's pretty beautiful. That's probably the best of his films for going along with the topic we're talking tonight. But many of them actually pull in little motifs from classical fairy stories. Hellboy Part 2, The Golden Army, has a lot of really cool magic and fairy references in it.
Mm-hmm. Which is a little bit what he tried to do with The Book of the Dead. He tried to make it into a mythology and didn't work.
I fell asleep. I can't say. I need to try again. Yeah, I fell asleep right away. And that's a common tool in the director's or the movie maker's tool belt too. Is, you know, if you can tap into the currents of myth, you pretty much have an audience, you know, because people can suddenly relate. You don't need a whole lot of backstory or exposition. People just feel, you know, the connection and what needs to happen and who's going to win. So yeah, that's a, it's a pretty common tool in the toolmaker's tool belt.
True. Dream Master says the universe works in many ways. Sublime is on the way. I have a question, since people don't have questions for you, but I have a question,
yeah,
and that will be probably the last question.
Okay.
So we know the Grimm fairy tales had different endings, and then there were change and all that. And then we know Disney,
yeah,
obviously, you know, Disneyfy every fairy tale.
Sure.
Do you think, because I've been told most of these are cautionary tales, you know, how to behave, how mm-hmm. to, you know, they all have a moral of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think with the changing of the endings, do they do a disservice now to our society, or do they still work as cautionary tales with all this moral now?
I do think they do a bit of disservice, but we'll jump into a totally different subject with that. I do think they do a bit of a disservice, and not that they don't function as their original intended, you know, cautionary tale, but as I think we've both seen, we're now in this culture where, you know, where we have all sorts of people, not even just little girls, but you know, who think that that they're a princess and just need the, someday the prince is going to come along and save them, and they don't have to do anything for it. And I do think that has been a disservice to society.
Mm-hmm. And we have one last question. Hunter Dowell says, what are some standard book or fairy tales or myths or legends that we should mm-hmm. have on our shelves?
Yes. So right after the show ends, I think we'll have some links posted. But one, Grimm's fairy tales, in whatever form, you know, whatever form it comes to you. If you like those, go for it. They also, if you really get into that, they're of course German fairy tales. And if you really get into that rabbit hole, you'll find out that there's also a lot of elements of German and Scandinavian, Icelandic mythos that has trickled into the stories as well. So Grimm's fairy tales, you can get at Barnes & Noble in one of those pretty like classic bound books for really inexpensive, or probably even less expensive for a Kindle or e-reader. The Pentamerone is an Italian collection of tales, literally the tale of tales. And that's, a great entry into the medieval folk belief system and elements that then influenced later on the German fairy tales that are famous from the Brothers Grimm. Those are both great places to start. What I've been noticing, and I didn't pull any of these up, so I can't give you specifics, but I did notice recently that there's been a lot of fairy tales being discovered lately that are from medieval periods. And so Amazon actually has some new like Penguin paperbacks of recently discovered fairy tales from different parts of the world. And so that's pretty cool. The Pentamerone, Grimm, there's one other I would mention, I'm blanking, but I would also check out then if you want to compare those to German mythology, the Volsung Saga, and, you know, an easy book on Greco-Roman mythology is Robert Graves, who also wrote, I believe, The White Goddess. So I would check out Robert Graves.
Okay, so there you have it for everyone. Of course, we're going to ask Aaron, we're going to kidnap him tomorrow, and we're going to ask to give us all those titles of those books. And
oh, I remember what the very
can...
last. Sorry, I remember what the very last suggestion was. Is of course Andrew Lang. Andrew Lang wrote a series of books called like the colored fairy books. So there's the red fairy book, the blue fairy book, the brown fairy book. He compiled these stories from all over the world, including the Americas. He did shorten them, adapt them, again, kind of sanitize them a little bit because they were very much intended for small children. But for the sheer scope of how many he collected and how many books he released, it's pretty amazing. And any of his books, if not the full collection, would be worth checking out. And he also has a really good sense of what qualifies as a fairy story. So if they're in one of his books, it's pretty much going to be a story that deals with the other land or characters that come from the other land.
Okay. Thank you so much, Aaron. Like I was saying, we're going to ask you to please, if you can, type us all those names and references so we can post it. For people that don't know, we have a page on Facebook. We have a page that is called Lunatic Mondays, Lunes Lunaticos. And either tonight or tomorrow, we're going to post there both the audio of this show so you can download it and you can listen to it later if you want to. And then some of the references and websites that Aaron has been sharing with us throughout the night. Before we go, Aaron, where people can find you? Can you give us, obviously, if they're interested on meeting you at the Brotherhood of the Phoenix or any future events, can you tell us about it, please?
Yes, please. So November 12th, I will be at an event called Shadow Dance with my brothers from Brotherhood of the Phoenix. This is in Chicago at the Mankind Project, which is 1900 West Fulton Avenue in Chicago. Shadow Dance is a celebration of the dark tide. So in the season of Samhain, it's when we connect with our ancestors and we connect with the energies of the underworld. But it's not scary. It's a celebratory ritual. So that'll be November 12th. Again, we'll post a link in the show on the show page. Beyond that, I can be found almost every day at Nightcap Coffee Bar in Chicago, which is 1738 West 18th Street. You can find both myself and Laura Gonzalez there, my beautiful host, on Tuesdays from noon to 6 p.m.
We're going to be doing tarot readings there tomorrow, by the way. I'm laughing because you say beautiful, and I was like, oh, thank you. I'm batting my eyelashes at you.
But actually, we have a fun event coming up at Nightcap Coffee Bar on Saturday. So we have our Halloween tea and tarot night. So after close, which on Saturdays is usually 7 p.m., we'll have an Akashic Records reader. We'll have tarot readers. We'll have a rune reader, and we'll be selling scary and delightful pastries for the Halloween celebration. And people can come receive $10 readings or readings for $1 a minute. It's a pretty huge savings. And we'll be having a lot of fun. So that's October 22nd, this coming Saturday at 7 p.m. at Nightcap Coffee Bar.
You had a pretty cool echo there when you said the date. I like that.
Nice.
So October 22nd at Nightcap, almost every day, Aaron will be serving you coffee and pastries. Please go and try the red wine cookies. They're vegan. They're delicious. And if there's not too many there, I'm sure I'm going to eat them tomorrow. And obviously, if you have the chance to go for the event, with the Brotherhood of the Phoenix, is going to be November 12th, Shadow Dance, a celebration of the dark tide. And this is only for men who love men.
Men who love 18, men, correct.
18 and older. Right?
Right.
Awesome.
That's it.
Thank you so much to everyone that was on the chat room. Darren, Hunter Dowell, Dream Master One, Robert Spellman, and Salji. Salji came almost at the end of the show, but hi, Salji. And Hunter says, hopefully I can make a trip to Chicago. Yeah, hopefully you can come. It's very close to downtown, actually. So
yeah,
you can take the train there. the Pink Line, 18th Street, right there. Thank you so much, Aaron, for being here on the show tonight and for giving us all these beautiful fairy tales. And
I think this is a topic we'll pick up again in the future, and we'll do next time we'll go into, which is why I didn't want to go into it today, but we'll go into more modern entries into the fairy tale mythos, and then we'll look at some more specific fairy tale motif.
Okay, so now since we're about to say goodnight, I want you to choose. So we can have a drum chant for Aradia, or we can have Tuatha Dé and Wendy Rule with the song Aradia. Which one do you like?
Oh, I've never heard the first one, so let's do that.
The first one?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you to everybody who listened to our show. We will be here next Monday in Spanish with Darío Van Rossati, and then 2 weeks from today, our celebration of 1 year anniversary with Celia Farren. So please join us. No, I'm lying. 2 weeks from today, this is going to be me talking about Day of the Dead. So if you're interested in knowing about the mythology and the origins of Day of the Dead, tune in on October 31st. And then a month from that, or 1 year anniversary, starting December, first week of December, we go to 8 o'clock. Thank you so much, Aaron. Thank you to everybody who was here on the show tonight.
Thanks, everybody.
Never forget, you are love. Good night.
Pagans Tonight. Pagans unite on Pagans Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.